So Christianity is hard to believe. A God who was unmade made everything. Humans made in his image with the capacity to love or to reject him. In fact, did reject him and suffer the wrath of God because his holiness required this response. And then God came to his creation as a man to die for us, thus serving both his love and justice at the same time. And this sounds far-fetched to some. But think about some of the alternatives that are out there, alternative worldviews. We're the products of chance plus time. The physical universe has always been, or more recently, the universe is self-created. And everything came from this self-created universe, love, purpose, hope, meaning. But these things are really illusions. They're not real things. And the diversity of the created order isn't created. It's all just the quirks of blind, undirected evolutionary processes. Ethics is purely contrived. Ultimately, it makes no difference if I hate you or love you, if I die for you or kill you. Or how about the worldview that everything is illusion, what the Hindus call Maya, that your sense of uniqueness or individuality is an illusion. Sin, sickness, death, these are not real. And our purpose is to, our solution is to escape illusion, to join mindless unreality, to be a drop of sore back in the cosmic ocean. We can go on and on and on, but there are so many views of reality. Reality itself is, it's fantastic. It's unbelievable. It's inconceivable, yet here it is. Something's true about the universe, and some things are not true. And what's hard to believe depends on what you believe. I believe and convinced that Christianity offers the coherent answers to life's greatest questions. We looked at them last week. Really, this month is one long message on multiple Sundays from Psalms 90. The ultimate questions: what is ultimate reality? Who are we? What's our problem? What's the solution to our problem? What's our purpose? What happens when we die? How do we know? And the Christian worldview, in my view, best describes life as we experience it, and also best prescribes a life well lived. If you look through history, look around, the Christian worldview explains what you see. If you try it, it works. And by that, I don't mean that it's just pragmatic, that Christianity is more than just something that works for me. But if something is true, you would expect it to work in real life, and it does. Now, there are people who say, I've tried it and it doesn't work. But by that, often they have a perception of what Christianity is. For instance, if I bargain with God, if I give my life to him, he'll keep problems from me. And then when problems continue, then they feel like it didn't work. Well, that wasn't really the gospel. Once a person is settled on a worldview, it determines how they see the world around you. It's why you can look at something, an event, or read something, and the person standing next to you sees the same thing and has a polar opposite view than you on that. And it can just be astounding. But it's because you're seeing the same thing, but you're not seeing through the same eyes. Your worldview determines how you see what you see. And once a person has settled on a worldview, it's extremely difficult to dislodge. And when it is dislodged, it can be traumatic. There are people who have gone through tragedies, gone to combat, and they had a worldview that didn't fit the world. And that dislodging of their worldview sometimes leads to PTSD. In the case of a person coming to Christ, it's the work of God in their hearts at a spiritual level. So when Jesus asked Peter, who do you say I am? He said, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, well, you didn't come to that on your own. God revealed that to you. And God will often use physical, relational, emotional pressures, troubles to unsettle our existing worldview, to show its inadequacy and to open us up to him. But for some people, their presuppositions about against God mean that they're blind to clear evidence for God. Something's true about reality. Reality is unbelievable. And so I want to encourage you, students, if there's a temptation to think, you know, what I've grown up with, if you've grown up in a church, what I've grown up with is unbelievable. But there are other views out there that are more believable, more conceivable. You know, if you get in your car after church and you drive straight north, you won't quite make it for an hour. You won't quite make it to Salina. But if you went out there and you could drive straight up. In about an hour, you'd make it into space. If you could drive straight down, it'd be a longer trip. It'd take you about 60 hours if you don't stop for potty breaks. But you better check your AC because it's going to be 11,000 degrees at the core, hotter than the surface of the sun. And speaking of trips, right now, we're on this big round spaceship. We're flying through space at 67,000 miles an hour. And in 4 hours' time, we would have traveled a distance from the earth to the moon. So all these fun and fantastic facts could go on and on. The fact is, we're used to all this. It just sounds normal. You say, no, this is just normal stuff. No, it's fantastic. We're walking on a thin surface, coating a core as hot as the sun. We live in a thin atmosphere that separates us from airless space. It's fantastic. No, it's normal. And this fantastic knowledge we do have is a tiny fraction of what can be known. So is Christianity, is the gospel hard to believe? No, it's impossible to believe apart from the grace of God. It's impossible to believe apart from faith. But none of that means it's imaginary or that every other way of believing about the universe is not faith-based as well. Everyone has a faith-based view of the world. Not everyone has a true view of the world. So don't be trapped into the kind of thinking that undermines your faith in what's real and true. Some believe that religion and science belong to separate domains. Religion is a domain of faith. Science is a domain of fact. There's a well-known paleontologist named Stephen Gould who says that religion and science deal with fundamentally distinct questions and should be kept completely apart. And there's two problems with this. One, it creates a two-story view of reality. Upstairs is the not-so-real, the world of faith, Jesus, Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny. Downstairs is the really real world, the world of science and facts. The other problem with it is that you can't separate the two because they talk about some of the same things. Now, the Bible doesn't talk about air conditioning or how to cure viruses, but they talk about very important things, both of them, like the origin of the universe and life. And this has implications for who we are as people, what our problem is, and then what the solution is. This is huge stuff. All people live by faith in what they believe to be the facts. By the way, Stephen Gould once famously remarked, "The evolution is impossible. There's no known mechanisms for what we see, but I believe it anyway because the alternative is unacceptable to me." Sounds like faith. He lives by faith in what he believes to be the facts. Everyone does. I could easily say, I live by faith. I live by facts. I put my faith in what I believe to be the facts. Otherwise, I put my faith elsewhere. Last week, we looked at who are we? We're made by God. From Psalms 90, we're like the grass. We're not at all like the grass. So the implications were, we're like the grass, here in the morning, gone at night. Teach us to number our days aright that we gain a heart of wisdom, 90 verse 12. And so when I look in the mirror, the response should be humility. Terry, you're like the grass. And then when I look in the mirror, I should see value. You're not at all like the grass. You're made and loved by God. When I look around me, I should see you're like the grass. Therefore, I cannot seek to impress you. I can't be wrongly impressed by you, but you're not at all like the grass. Therefore, I should seek to bless you because you're loved and made by God. And this week, the great question is, what's our problem? And the answer is, we're unmade by sin. So listen as we hear Psalm 90 again.
Psalm 90. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the whole world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn people back to dust, saying, "Return to dust, you mortals. 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. Yet you sweep people away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. In the morning it springs up new, but by evening it is dry and withered. We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a moan. Our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures, yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. If we only knew the power of your anger, your wrath is as great as the fear that is your due. Teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Relent, Lord, how long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble. May your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. May the favor of the Lord our God rest on us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands.
So there are different answers to the question, what's our greatest problem? Some say it's an unequal distribution of resources. Some believe that we have bad memory. In Islam, sin is a problem, but to some degree, the man's problem is forgetfulness. He forgets who he is, he forgets who God is. We're stupid and forgetful. And so the five pillars, prayer and alms and fasting and pilgrimage and confession, those things help people remember. For the Christian Scientist or the Hindu, illusion is the problem. For the Buddhist, desire is the problem. Suffering is caused by desire. The way to eliminate suffering is eliminate desire. For some, ignorance is a problem. For some, religion is a problem. For some, that's the same thing. And the answer to what our greatest problem is flows from who or what ultimate reality is and who we are. And the implications are, what are we going to look for our solution? And the Bible's answer to our greatest problem is sin. It's rebellion. And sin's consequence, separation from God, God's wrath. And in the passage, in the chapter Paul read, we saw God's wrath is as great as the fear that is due him. And only by appreciating the bad news can we appreciate the good news. And it matters. It matters a lot. If a doctor believes wrong about your physical problem, he or she is going to act wrong in regards to the solution. The same thing is true for an electrician, a plumber, a politician, a general officer. When a diagnosis is wrong, the consequences are real, and they can be devastating. And never more devastating than when the diagnosis of humanity's greatest problem is wrong. And the psalmist indicates that we're under God's wrath and that this is justly deserved. And he's admitting that God's wrath is our just due. Let's jump from Psalms 9 to Romans, which is the most detailed and clearest explanation of the gospel. And Paul said in Romans 1:16, he said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. And the word gospel, as we talked about, means good news. And so Paul is, of course, not ashamed of the good news. But what comes next is a bit of a surprise, because in verse 18, he says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And so he announces the good news, but instead of launching right into an explanation of this wonderful truth, we get this dire news about God's wrath against our sin. And it's going to be two full chapters before Paul gets back to talking about the good news again. And the reason why is because Paul evidently agrees that by only understanding the bad news can we appreciate the good. And without an appreciation for our problem, we'll not have an appreciation for God's solution. And like the psalmist, Paul used wrath to describe God's reaction to our sin. And wrath is a little bit of an old word. It's unlikely you've used it in normal conversations in the past week or months. You may have said, you made me angry, or I got angry, but it's unlikely you said to your children or coworkers, behold my wrath. It's not something, maybe Justin, maybe you have. He has. So most people don't use wrath anymore. It's God's reaction to sin. It's not the emotion, the anger of an emotional person. It's a necessary reaction of a holy God to sin. And wrath is a really good word for this reality. God's wrath doesn't mean he's pouting because he's not getting what he wants. We're not doing what he wants. It's not his pettiness. His wrath is his appropriate response to our sin. He cannot not be himself. And to not look at sin with what we call wrath would be impossible. And it says that God's wrath is on those who suppress the truth, and one can only suppress something of which they have some knowledge of. So in verse 19, he says, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal nature, divine power, have been clearly seen from what God has made, so people are without excuse. And some call this general revelation, meaning it's available to everywhere all the time, as opposed to special revelation, which would be Jesus and the Bible. And so we can't know the gospel from general revelation, but we can know information about the existence of God and some of his qualities. And these are the things that people, even without a Bible, even without a Christian witness, have available to them. And God says they've rejected that information, what he's revealed to them. So don't think of a giant temper tantrum or a passive-aggressive deity. His wrath is his settled disposition against human sin. And when we see human anger, we never see anger in its pure, non-sinful form. In God, his anger is like his love. It's perfect. It's sinless. And I don't confess to fully understand this, but it's not hard to believe. I can be angry at cancer in a child's body. In fact, it's hard to imagine not having some degree of anger at cancer in a child's body and being a healthy human being at the same time. And of course, my anger is always going to be tainted by sin nature, so I'm prone to redirect my anger towards God. But my point is, his wrath directed at human sin is right. He's not going to stop being who he is, and his holiness requires it. And the wrath of God is not a passive thing. It's not purely cause and effect. This is an important distinction. Cause and effect means you jump off the roof, you fall to the ground, you break your leg. Cause, you jumped. Effect, you broke your leg. Why? Gravity. And sin can sometimes be presented as a pure cause and effect reality. If you sin, you suffer the natural consequences God's built into the natural order. But it is, God has made a largely cause and effect world, but not entirely, because you could jump off the roof and God could choose to intervene. God does choose to intervene and bring judgment on sin. Because a purely cause and effect world is called deism. It's a worldview that says God made the world and then went off and let it run on its own. There's a God, but he's not involved. He's not personal. So he made a clock, he wound the clock, set it out there in space, and now he's off doing something else. And when a clock runs down, time is up. H.G. Wells, who wrote The War of the Worlds, was a good example of deism. He had a very convoluted worldview, kind of a mixture, but he was part deist, and in his book, made into a couple of movies, you know, the aliens invade, our nukes can't stop them, our bombs can't stop them, and then they die of cold or some virus kills them off. And the narrator at the end of the story says, from the moment the invaders arrived, breathed their air, ate and drank, they were doomed. They were undone, destroyed after all of man's weapons and devices had failed by the tiniest of creatures that God in his wisdom put upon the earth. So these germs killed them. And what's significant about that in H.G. Wells' world, God didn't answer human prayers and stop these aliens. And these aliens were no part of God's judgment on human sins. This was just the pre-programmed earth taking care of itself. He was not actively involved in judgment or in love. That's deism. God made everything, then he left. We're fatherless. That's not Christianity. God is involved. He's personal. There is a cause and effect world, but he's not put the cosmos on autopilot. He's active in his love. He's active in his wrath. He's a good parent. And wrath is the right response to God of our sin. So sin is our greatest problem, or you could say it creates our greatest problem, which is separation from God. Now some would say, maybe if they, and maybe you're here and you're saying, I don't really buy into this, because all this theology talk inside this church walls, it doesn't translate into the real world out there of real problems, hunger and war and disease and abuse, the real problems of humanity. But that is the question. What is the real problem? What's the base problem? And it matters that you get that diagnosis right, because what you think is the problem will determine what you think is the solution. Watch this short video, and then I'll tell you why we're watching this video.
The myth of overpopulation originated in England in 1798, when a vicar named Thomas Malthus, who fancied himself something of a mathematician, saw that food production increased incrementally, but people reproduced exponentially. He sat down and did some simple math, and summarily decided that the world would be out of food by 1890. He blamed reduced mortality rates, and recommended killing off the have-nots of society, lest the haves starve to death. This cry was taken up by Paul Ehrlich of Stanford University in 1968, who claimed that reckless human reproduction had overwhelmed the earth. Massive famines would result, which would destroy, best case scenario, one-fifth of humanity by the end of the 70s. And the planet would follow. This fear produced large donations for the newly created UNFPA, which thrives on an imagined crisis that has been both imminent and rescheduled again and again over the past two centuries. The truth of the matter is that every family on this planet could have a house, with a yard, and all live together on a landmass the size of Texas, which is really just a small corner of the planet. The population of Earth will peak in 30 years, and then start to go back down. We're not overpopulated. Do the math.
See, the organization that produced this back in 2009, they don't say it in the short video, but the reason why they make this is because the implications for believing this is the main problem have been catastrophic for human beings. And so if you believe that the central problem of humanity is overpopulation, then like Thomas Malthus, you know, you're going to get rid of the undesirables, and that's been the case. It matters. If you get the problem wrong, you get the solution wrong. And sometimes those perceived problems are benign, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're terrible. I heard a lecture a couple months ago by a guy named Dr. Mitchum. He's a linguist, speaks 7 languages and some more, not as fluently. He's a political advisor for the Air Force, Vietnam combat veteran, well-traveled guy. And he said, the worldwide problem is not of lack of resources. There is a distribution problem. There's plenty to go around. He doesn't mean that government should come in and take and give. But he says, here's the reasons why it's not going around. And he began to describe the reasons that he's seen and he advises leaders on. And as he was speaking, I said, he's describing human sin in various forms. He's describing bad ideas of human government. He's describing despotic leaders. He's describing selfish, sinful people who are not leaders. Sin is our greatest problem. It's our root problem. And if we miss this diagnosis, we're going to miss the cure. And sin has lasting effects. It has ripple effects. It has generational effects. I said last week that all disasters are ultimately local. So if you have a disaster that overwhelms a city and it gets too big and it takes over the county and a nation gets involved, it still is going to come down to, in the end, local people. It's local homes, local lives who are there when the national help leaves. And all sin is local before it ever goes global. It's the ripple effect of a choice. And God knows, but if you could just see the series of sinful choices that lead to a Stalin or a Hitler and the terror famine in Russia or the killing of 20 million Jews. Sin starts local and it has lasting impact. Ernest Alexander was singing at a church years ago. He's telling me this 2 weeks ago. He had an old man come up to him. The man was maybe 80 years old, and he began to weep and said, "Can I speak to you?" Ernest said, "Sure." Ernest didn't know the guy, and he said, "I've never told this story to anybody. This is the first time." I'm not sure why he felt safe, but he just did. And he said, "When I was a boy," he was 5 or 8 years old, "his grandfather began to abuse him. His grandfather sexually assaulted him for some years. And then the man grew up, and he got married, and he had a couple of children, and he had some grandchildren. And he lived his whole life, never telling anybody, in terror that he would become an abuser. And so he had less and less physical intimacy with his wife. He didn't touch his children. He didn't touch his grandchildren. And so they grew up. Here he is, 80 years old. They grew up thinking, Grandpa's a cold, uncaring guy. And he's been living in terror because of a sin that was done to him when he was a boy. And Ernest said, "You have to go tell your family why they've been seeing what they've been seeing for the last 50, 60 years. And then what about disease? Okay, that explains human choices. What about disease? How is that related to sin? My granddaughter Nora, who has this rare congenital disease, and you know that means a machine has to help her breathe. Who sinned? Whose fault is that? Well, Adam and Eve, us. Biblically, even sin is, even disease is directly related to human sin. Not meaning that if you're sick, you sinned, or if your kid gets sick, go find out what you did wrong. That's not biblical at all. Matter of fact, people even came to Jesus and said, "Who sinned that these happened to these people?" And Jesus said, "No one sinned. That's not why it happened, but that the glory of God would be revealed." But as in, even in sickness, when humans fell into sin, the created order fell with them. Genesis 3, Romans 8. Sin is our greatest problem. You know, spirituality is in right now. In the military, there's a resiliency training, comprehensive airman fitness, and one of the 4 pillars is spirituality. Best-selling books and speakers are spiritual. Being Christian is uncool in academia right now, in Hollywood and elsewhere, but being spiritual is cool. And technically, it's a stolen word because Christians, we are spiritual. But what they mean by that is spirituality minus the biblical foundations. And so spirituality tends to be inclusive. except when excluding exclusivists like Christians. Spirituality tends to be benevolent, benign. As long as you don't hurt anybody, it's really okay. It doesn't qualify as wrong. But there is no holy and righteous God whose very nature demands that he react negatively to sin. There's no wrath of God. In fact, the phrase would be an oxymoron for the spiritual. But the truth is, there's no holy God without the wrath of God. Our sin separates us from God. The basic problem there is the root of all other problems. And biblically, separation from God is the root cause of separation between people. Human wars go back to sin, separating people. Divorces, all abuse of people, all those things are related to human sin. Separation from God is the cause of the separation we feel in ourselves, the struggles we have in ourselves. And we'll get to the good news next week. This week we need to clearly look at the bad news. And some may say, well, Terry, that's the Old Testament God. That's not Jesus. Well, you go to the New Testament and you see Jesus consistently talking about judgment and wrath. In Revelation 21, Jesus is being spoken of, and he's talking about the wrath that's going to come on those who persist and die in their sins. That's Jesus. That's the wrath of God on sin. And someone who wandered in here and they don't know us, they may say, well, there you have it. You finally revealed your true colors. You are another one of those judgmental Christians throwing down wrath. I don't have any wrath to throw down on people. Or I have no right to throw down wrath. Jesus warned of wrath. Jesus warned of God's judgment on sin. Then he allowed himself to be tortured and killed and suffered God's wrath for us. He spoke the truth that sin deserves God's wrath. Then he lived the truth that God loves us enough to provide a solution for our problem. Years ago, I heard a paraphrase that false prophets will speak only of God's love, but if you watch their lives, they'll live a life of wrath. And true prophets, they'll speak of God's wrath with tears, but if you watch their lives, they'll live a life of God's love. That was Jesus. That was Paul. That was Jeremiah. So last night in Orlando, about 20 were killed at a nightclub. Many, many more were injured. And it's terrible, heartbreaking news. And I don't know if some individual believed he was doing something right, exercising God's judgment on people he disagreed with. We'll never know the total facts because he died. And people will tend to spin it one way or the other. And the club itself was a place of wickedness. It was centered on illicit sex. I read what the club said about itself, that they encouraged people to come and indulge your temptations. And so it was hurting people's lives. I've talked to the people recently who have been hurt by those kind of behaviors and the destruction that follows. But we should weep over those who were murdered and those whose lives were changed by these horrific injuries. Because unlike movies where you shoot somebody and they kind of shake it off with a little dirt on it, in real life, you shoot somebody, you know, it's a horrific, often it's a horrific life-changing injury. So we should be people who tell with tears of God's wrath on sin. At the same time, we should speak and show with our lives God's love for sinners. Psalm 90, verse 7, we're consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. There are no secret sins. There are sins that we think are secret. All our days pass under your wrath. So that's the bad news that precedes the good. Fortunately, the Bible doesn't end there. And we'll talk next week of the good news, but of course you don't have to wait a week to enjoy and live in the good news. Romans 8:32, it says, who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also along with him graciously give us all things? And all things are not a Cadillac. All things mean here the forgiveness of sins, the power to live outside the control of sin. So we're going to spend some time, a few minutes, worshiping God together, the God who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. And as you worship, if you believe the gospel, reflect on the fact that even though you have problems, we all have problems. We have relational problems and physical problems, financial problems. But reflect on the fact that Jesus has solved what is your greatest problem. Let's pray together. Would you talk to God about your life? Would you certainly take your problems to him, but would you rejoice that through Jesus Christ he has offered a solution to your greatest problem?